This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Bill Carter, an award-winning documentary filmmaker, photographer, and journalist. Bill is author of Red Summer, The Danger, Madness, and Exaltation of Salmon Fishing in a Remote Alaskan Village, and A Fool Thrush Inn, a true story of love, war, and redemption. He has written for Rolling Stone, Outside, and other publications, and directed the award-winning documentary Miss Sarajevo. Bill Carter is here today to tell us about his most recent book, Boom Bust Boom, A Story About Copper, the Metal That Runs the World. Welcome, Bill.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
It's good to have you. What led you to write your book, Boom Bust Boom?
Yeah, you know, copper's not a topic I really thought I would ever write about. But I lived in southern Arizona for the last 15 years, 10 of those years being in Bisbee, Arizona. And even though there's a large open pit mine that's dormant on the edge of my town, I never really thought about it. I just thought this is a really interesting town to live in. And then a few things happened. One was I became a commercial fisherman during that time in Bristol Bay, Alaska. So I started to learn about the possibilities of pebble mine. I didn't know the details. I didn't know much. I just knew there was going to be a mine, or might be a mine. The second thing that happened is I got married and had a daughter, and then we were having a second daughter, and I started to make a garden. And during this time of making the garden, a lot of the town was having their yards reclaimed by the mining company because their soils were high in various heavy metals. And I didn't really think about that either. And so I just made my garden. I was very intense, and I wanted to share it with my daughter and eat the food. And so I built a very elaborate system of a garden. And then I started to eat it. And my wife wouldn't because she was pregnant and she didn't trust it. And I kind of thought she was being overreactive. And in the end, I got very sick. And the mining company came out right away because we had a pregnant situation. And they tested the soil and it was very high in arsenic and also in lead. They'd replaced all my soil. They've replaced almost all the soil in Bisbee at this point. And just to be clear, I would later learn this, is that the mining company that owns that mine today is not responsible for this dirt being contaminated. It happened about 100 years ago when they had a smelter in Bisbee, and the smelters are very poisonous, toxic things. That got me thinking about writing a book, like, where do I live? You know, I own a home here. I love it here. I have really great friends. But do I want to keep living here? And that led me to explore copper and explore the world of copper mining and understand it better.
How extensive is the use of copper in today's society?
That question is the thing that's totally shocked me more than anything when I started to research the book. You can't do anything without copper in today's world. Let's say we were to take copper away, we would basically be immediately thrown into the 1800s. Anything that's electrical, computers, cars, every car has 50 pounds, every airplane has about 400 pounds, every home has a copper in it. It's extraordinarily that pervasive metal in our lives, which creates a dichotomy. You know, we need the copper to live the life we live. I like my iPhone, you like your computer. But to get that copper, we have to create these massive, huge holes, essentially, in the earth. And the holes themselves, they can be also a separate environmental nightmare, but it's what they take out and they put into huge piles. That's the root cause of the environmental damage from copper mining, because copper doesn't come by itself. The copper, the metal itself, is quite magical. It's what comes with it, what was mineralized with it 150 million years ago on the way up through the earth. Comes with it is uranium, cesium, arsenic. There's a lot of things that come with it. It doesn't just come alone. And getting that out is what's the problem.
Would you elaborate on the use of copper for renewable energy projects?
Yeah, another tricky one, because we all know, or we should know, that renewable energy is really the only way forward in the long term for human beings. And that's the right thing to do. However, people don't realize how much copper is used to make renewable energy, much more than like coal or gas. If you have a big, huge solar farm or a wind farm, there's going to be an enormous amount of copper in those wind turbines or in those solar farms. You know, you're going to have huge generating plants moving electricity from that solar farm in the middle of Arizona to California or wherever you're sending it. So going to renewable energy will probably solve the big problem, but it's going to still have copper demand attached to it.
And how about the internet?
You know, the way we access the internet is where copper is used, which is computers and wires. That's all copper. The average computer has about 1.5 pounds of copper. A cell phone has 16 grams of copper. There's a billion cell phones on Earth. There's going to be more. There's going to be more computers. So the internet is just going to get bigger, and our dependence on computers is going to be bigger. So yes, you have a lot of copper in those items.
Why is copper used so widely? What properties make it so popular?
Yeah, copper really is quite phenomenal. It conducts electricity very well. It heats very well and becomes cool very fast. The only time they ever tried to replace it, they tried to replace it once in the 70s because the price was too high. So they thought they would try aluminum, which also is a conductor, but it's not very stable. And a bunch of houses caught on fire from the electrical charge. And so the only other thing that you could possibly replace it with that we know of is two items that we'll never use, which are gold and platinum. Those are extraordinarily expensive. Copper's around $4 a pound. We know gold is $1,000 an ounce, so that's not going to happen. It just has an ability. It's like the perfect metal. Also, to you and I, copper is an amazing thing. It has a great medical benefit. It kills bacteria on touch. So it's quite an extraordinary metal. In and of itself, it's fantastic. Just getting it's the problem.
Would you give some historical context? How long have humans been mining copper, and what were the uses in the past?
It's the oldest known metal that we've mined for as human beings. Right now, we can go back about 10,000 years. The oldest artifact found was a comb. The first mine civilizations were in northern Iraq, probably in Syria. Also, the Egyptians were quite big on copper. They had a huge copper industry in the Sinai. The Romans were, of course, the people that really took it to a new level because they mixed copper with, they made bronze, and that allowed them to create armies with fantastic weapons. So the Roman Empire really, in many ways, was an expansion to get these metals, like tin from Wales and England, and copper from Spain. Huge copper mines in Spain at that time. There's a copper mine in Spain that's been basically around for 4,000 years, Rio Tinto. There's one in Cyprus. Cyprus means copper, and it was kind of the original center of the copper industry, and the Romans ran that too, and that's been around 4,000 years, and they just opened that mine again recently. So copper's been around a long, long, long time. Gold has always been used, like copper, for ornamental things, but copper had a different purpose. You know, it was the Romans that found out first that if you use copper as a goblet to drink out of, they didn't have the science down, but they realized people didn't get sick because copper goblets and cups didn't make you ill because it killed bacteria on touch. They probably didn't know that, but they did realize it worked better than using a wood one. So it's been around a long, long time.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Bill Carter, author of the book Boom Bus Boom, A Story About Copper, the Metal That Runs the World. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Where is most of the copper mining being done currently?
The big players in the world, by far the biggest, and has been for hundreds of years, is Chile. Chile dominates the world copper production. Interestingly enough, Chile a long time ago realized they didn't want to process copper because of the smelters are very poisonous. So they basically export 100% of their copper is made into a concentrate and shipped to China. They don't touch it after it comes out of the ground. The United States is usually third or fourth in the world for copper production, with the vast majority of that being Arizona. Southern Arizona is one of the world's biggest copper belts. Russia's big. China's big. China does a lot of copper, but they use so much copper making products for the rest of the world that they don't even come close to the copper they need. So that we send our copper to China. Chile sends their copper to China. Everybody sends their copper to China because they make all the goods.
Who controls the copper industry? How big are the companies and where are they located?
Yeah, you know, that also was a really fascinating thing for me to research. Because, you know, like most corporations, we don't really know who they are unless we have a sense of who Microsoft is because you live in Seattle maybe. But copper companies are really the oldest companies that we know of. Because before that, they were something else. This goes back hundreds of years. They didn't just come out of nowhere. And the biggest ones are in London and Australia. They're the big players in the copper mining industry and the mining industry in general. And in South Africa, Australia, definitely the big one. So you have Rio Tinto, Anglo-American, Grupo Mexico, and the biggest copper company in the world is actually based in Arizona, and it's Freeport-McMoRan, who owns the mines in Bisbee and everywhere else in Arizona. And they also own a very large mine in the Congo. And they probably own the most, the word I'm going to use is maybe evil, but they own the most outrageously damaging mine in the world. It's in Grasberg in Papua New Guinea. It's a copper mine and a gold mine. The story behind that mine is horrendous compared to anything else really that goes on in the world of mining. They're pretty nice in Arizona, you know, because they live in America and they have to be good neighbors, but they're not very nice in that country.
What are the issues in Papua New Guinea?
It's in West Papua New Guinea, so it's technically Irian Jaya. But since 1970, they have really run a clandestine mining operation that no one can get to. No one's allowed into this place. Up until 2005, when they were basically busted by the New York Times, they hired the Indonesian military to be the Pinkertons, the police force, which, by the way, is illegal for a U.S. company to hire another government's army as their police. Many people have died at the hands of the army because there's different indigenous groups there that have been resisting the mine, and they've been killed, put in jail by the hundreds. So you have basically a battle going on between the military and the indigenous group, all being financed by Freeport-McMoRan. But the scale of this mine is extraordinary. It's the largest gold mine in the world and the third largest copper mine. They put 300,000 tons of waste rock into two local rivers, just piling it in the rivers, which has created a 30-mile sulfuric acid plume into the Arafat Sea in Indonesia, which basically is a dead zone. It's killing that part of the sea. There's no real stopping them, because Indonesia is not our country, and they run whatever they want to do. And they've contributed billions of dollars to Indonesia, you know, central government.
Would you say more about the mining process itself? What actually happens?
You know, you think about like a kid's game. The scale is different. That's the problem. But you have a big machines that have to identify ore. Once you identify it, you basically dig it out. You have to take what they call an overburden. Copper doesn't sit on the surface anymore. It used to, but that's all gone. So you have to basically take away a lot of earth to get to where you're going. You're going to create an open pit. Once you take it out of the ground, there's different ways to actually extract copper from, they call it ore, from the other materials that are attached to it. So you can smelter it, which is basically a heat process, or you can leach it out. And the way they do that is they create a huge pile, what they call tailings piles, and they pulverize this thing now. It's been really, really pulverized through crushers, so it's very fine, almost like a dust, and it sits on these huge, in Morenci, Arizona, this is 7,500 acres, this tailings piles. Then they have a sprinkler system on top that sprays it with a combination of water and sulfuric acid, and that does what air and water would do naturally. Once you expose what's in the earth to air and water, it starts to decay. Sulfuric acid will be born from that process. So they just speed it up. They just drench it with sulfuric acid, which then leaches out the copper, but it also leaches out arsenic, uranium, many other metals that are attached to copper. They have a way of extracting only the copper from that process because it goes into a drip system at the bottom. Then it gets into a tank, and they know how to basically create cathodes from an electrical process that only the copper will come to. The other stuff is your problem, and it's just sitting out there in that tailings pile for eternity, constantly going where? Into the ground, into the aquifers, into the rivers. And this is the problem that all large-scale mines have, is they can get the copper out, but they don't know how to keep the other stuff from going into the ground. So it's not simple, but you know, you take something out of the earth, you're going to polarize it, you're going to purify what you want, and then the rest of it goes away.
Well, you've started alluding to this, but would you say more about the environmental impacts of the copper mining?
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about the fact that the biggest problem, and it's not a problem that they don't think about constantly. Copper mining companies think about this all the time. They're not sitting there, I don't think, trying to just ignore it. They have amazing geologists, hydrologists, people working on this. But when you take 5 to 10 billion tons of waste out of the ground, waste rock, it's not waste, it's rock, that's been mineralized, you're going to have a runoff. You're also going to have other problems. You can have air problems because these trucks that are running around, mining operations are 24 hours a day. They're 24 hours a day for 20 to 50 to 75 years. These trucks are phenomenal in their size, and they have huge piles. They have 600 tons of dirt in the back. And if you live near a mine, you know it, because your air is full of kind of a dust. And in that dust is all these minerals we're talking about and all these metals. So that's a big problem. Sound's a big problem. But the biggest problem that we face is really water. And no one has figured out how to stop a large-scale mine from not infiltrating the surrounding aquifers and water systems. No one knows how to do it. Not because they're not trying, because of the scale of it.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Bill Carter, author of the book Boom Bust Boom, a story about copper, the metal that runs the world. What is life like for people living in a mining town?
Most of the mining towns that I have visited, and there's a lot of them in southern Arizona, it's a different kind of life. I mean, there's two company towns in Arizona that actually literally are company towns, which don't really exist much in the United States anymore, where everything is owned by the company, everything. The stores, the schools, everything is owned by them. And those two towns are very close. It's like almost entering like a religious enclave. They generally don't talk to outsiders. They're protective because the company basically pays them everything, subsidize the homes. But you don't have to live in a mining town, like literally a company town, to understand a mining town. The reason I called the book Boom Bust Boom is because of what mining towns are. When a mine company decides that there's something there they want, right? They've done their testing, they're ready to go, they've done some permitting. In this process, over 5 to 10 years, they will start to spend a lot of money in that little town. And everybody's pretty happy. It's a pretty good time. It's a boom. If you watch the evolution of long-term mining towns like Morenci in Arizona, or Ajo, or Baghdad, or Superior, these are all mining towns in Arizona, there's always a bust. When the price drops in the world market, or the ore runs out, or whatever happens, when they leave town overnight, and it all goes away, and there's no more money, and that place is depressed and ugly and boarded up and essentially abandoned. And then you've seen in the last 15, 10 years, real advances in copper technology for leaching and for getting more copper out of less ore, like meaning the percentage of copper is less, but it's price effective to get it. So they're going back to these same towns now. The copper doesn't go away. They just didn't find it profitable to do at the time. But now they're starting to revisit all those mines and possibly open them again. So they're going to have another boom, and you can have this recycle of boom, bust, boom again. And, you know, Bisbee's a really good example. The old miners from that place loved Phelps Dodge, who used to own the town, and they loved the mine, kind of. It's weird. They loved what it did for their families and put their kids in school, but they hated the pollution. They always worried about it. They didn't like the labor situation in Arizona. The unions were broke in 83, so there's no more unions. You know, there's a lot of things that go on in a mining town. There's a lot of factors. But it is a fascinating group of people to talk to. They're very proud, and they should be. I have a lot of friends that are real environmental activists, and they want to, you know, protest against every mine, and they want to rail against every miner. And I think you're just not living in reality, because you're talking to me on the phone, which has copper. And so until you can address the whole equation, you know, you can't just say that. You can't just blanket say that they're all bad. That's not true. Yeah, they do a lot of good in the world too, the miners. So it's a very tricky situation.
What are your thoughts on solutions for this issue of needing copper but still having a process that is destructive both to communities and also to the environment?
I don't really know. There's no answer yet. I think there will be eventually. You know, the world is moving very fast. Nanotechnology, some sort of carbon alloy. Something's going to be created where it possibly undermines copper and takes its place. What it is, I don't know. But we're moving so fast in so many ways that it's hard to imagine that something doesn't come up in our life. It won't happen overnight, but it probably will happen. In the meantime, I think one of the biggest issues that came to me writing this book, because people were frustrated. So, okay, what do we do? What's the way out of this? Is to live with it, but live with it in a better way, which the only way to do that is to do something that we have not a lot of power, which is to change the 1872 Mining Law Act. And I know a lot of your listeners know about that act. It's a 140-year-old law that rules the United States and it has no relevancy how it's written back then to today. And we need to change it. We don't need to like get rid of mining. We need to write the law better so that we understand what they're doing, they're responsible for cleaning this up, and how they go about it, and how they pay the United States for using the land. Because right now they don't pay anything. They pay nothing. And that's ridiculous, you know? And the Superfund sites, we're spending around $200 billion eventually on Superfund sites. And that's on us. And that shouldn't be on us. That should be on the companies that profited from doing what they did. To have it on us is just ridiculous.
To what extent are mining companies regulated?
They're regulated in kind of a general way. Air quality, if they, for instance, in Morenci, that somebody by mistake dumped 160,000 gallons of sulfuric acid in a creek bed. It was stopped, you know, right away, blah, 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 and they paid a fine. So most regulation in the United States comes down to money, meaning your air quality is bad, so the in Tucson today, they fine the big mining company on the outside of Tucson something for that day, you know, $50,000. So if you're a mining company, it's just built into the equation of doing business. They're going to have these fines. So they're regulated like that. There's certain rules you have to apply to like leaching fields and these ponds they have. But the regulation is really a money issue.
How much recycling of copper goes on?
Recycling is a really important part of this equation of the world supply of copper. I've had a lot of people ask me about this question as if it could solve everything. Like, hey, man, why don't we just recycle all of the copper? Won't we be able to take care of this? The answer is not even close. The good news is the copper is, going back to your a while ago question, copper is this magical metal. And one of the things that's magical about it is it's 100% recyclable. It is believed that 80% of everything that's been dug out of the ground for 10,000 years, copper, is still on Earth and still in products that you're using. Because all you have to do with copper is take it to a local junkyard, turn it in. They're going to send it to a small smelter, not big ones, in towns like, I'm sure they're around here. And bam, you have purified copper again. But in terms of the big issue, which is supply and demand of copper in the world, right now we use around 18 million tons the world. By 2025, we're going to use about 25 million tons. The vast majority being places like India, China, us. That's not going to come from recycling. But recycling is a really important stopgap that happens when the world supply gets short and they can't get the copper out fast enough. Recycling is what happens. That's what fills the gap. And almost all of the stuff in America that's sent to scrapyards in copper form, all of it goes to China. We pretty much send it all there.
In your book, you interviewed a number of different people in the mining industry, from miners to CEOs of the mining companies. Could you share some of their perspectives?
For miners, the guy who's driving the truck or working the maintenance or whatever, the miner guy, that was always a great experience. I mean, they're always just people who are just trying to live their life and kind of pay their way. And they were always salt of the earth kind of people, just like they literally salt of the earth, the movie. They were all just like you think they are, real dedicated people, honest workers. The CEOs are a different group of people, and they have a different way of looking at the world. And the CEOs that I met and the people that were the big executives, I took a trip with John Shively, who's the CEO of Pebble Partnership, trying to get Pebble Mine started in Alaska. And I went on a helicopter tour with him and six other mining lobbyists from various states. I'm always amazed he let me in these helicopters, but he did. And we took a tour of Pebble Mine, and then we met afterwards for a long talk, and they just think about the world differently. And a couple scientists pointed this out to me. They tell me, you know, here's the risk, here's what's going to happen. This is scientifically what's going to happen. But a miner has, when I say a miner now, I don't mean the guy that's driving a truck. I mean the guy that runs the business. They think differently than us. Their idea of risk is different than us. I'm not willing to risk having Pebble Mine destroy the salmon fishery. But a miner, the risk is about money and about acceptable risk. So they think it's worth it because they can fix the problem if it goes wrong in terms of paying out money that will still make the mine profitable. So when you're talking to them, you can't really connect in the same way. You can't say, hey, this makes no sense. This absolutely makes no sense. You're going to actually kill the fishery. They're like, no, we'll kill part of the fishery. And for that part of the fishery, we'll pay for it. And we'll still make money. And you'll still have copper for your little toys. And everybody wins. Now, that's not acceptable to me or people that care about the issue of Pebble Mine, but that's an example of how they think and how other people think. And they see it real black and white. And their argument really goes down to really one thing. It's always boiled down to one thing, which is we're providing something that you all need. And so if you don't ever need it anymore, I won't keep digging this hole. So until you stop needing it, don't bother me. You know, it's kind of where it always goes. And, you know, in some ways, they're right. And that's why I said we have to figure out a way to amend the 1872 law so that we can sometimes say no. Because right now in the United States, as a people, we don't have the ability to say no to a mine. There is no way for us to say no. The only people who can say no are the EPA. But we, let's say we had a popular vote. Okay, this is hypothetical. And we said, I don't want you to build a mine in Tacoma because I just think that's a really bad idea. And every single person in Tacoma voted against it. And every single person in every place around there voted against it. It wouldn't make it not happen because we have no way to access the process. The only way we can access the process of the permitting and mining operation is through the EPA using the Clean Water Act. And that is used in incredibly rare circumstances. So you can't rely on the EPA to come in and save the day. So it's frustrating. And that's my big solution, isn't to get rid of them or create a new technology overnight. It's we have to work with the reality that they're here, we're here, and we got to figure this out in a way that helps them mine, but helps us have better control over maybe where and how.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I don't know. You know, the book is it's a journey of many things. And one of them is me as a dad trying to understand what to do. Should I leave the town I love? And that's the kind of the personal narrative through the story. And the second one is, and I'm sure your listeners already are, but like it's being mindful of what we are, this creature, this human beings running around on the planet. Whatever we're using had to come from somewhere. And there's a price to pay for that. Not literally the price of your product, but like the price of extracting that. And we have to kind of have a holistic view of all this and realistic one too. And if I ever have a message, it actually has to do with Pebble Mine, which I know your listeners know about, is I would let many, many mines go forward in my book, but I would never let Pebble go forward. Because I believe very strongly that in the next 100 years, Earth, as people on Earth, we're going to have to make some radical decisions. And one of them is going to be the choice between mineral extraction, which we need to live a modern life, and food and water. And these two things don't go together. Mineral extraction basically kills food and water sources. Nowhere is that more obvious than Pebble Mine. If you create Pebble Mine, you will threaten and kill this fishery, which is a world resource of food. It's not just like the guys in Alaska eating salmon. The whole world eats that salmon. It's exported to Asia, to Europe, to lower 48. So I would say that we have to create a stop on that one and then see where that takes us. But it's a good place to say no. So I'd encourage people to participate in the EPA process and put a public comment in when they ask you to.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Bill. You were just listening to Bill Carter, author of the book Boom, Bust, Boom, A Story About Copper, the Metal That Runs the World, published in October 2012 by Simon & Schuster. For more information, check on the web at billcarter.cc. Again, that's billcarter.cc. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Demand, and then Podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and kexp.org.